Dr. Shiraz Box joins us. Shiraz, welcome to the program. I appreciate your time. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a really important time. It's definitely a different time for many of us. So I want to get to kind of some of the basic ones that I think a lot of people want to know about. Right now, do we know how long coronavirus lives on surfaces? Because I know everybody, you know, we're diligent, we're washing our hands and stuff like that, watching where we cough. But if you're walking around and let's say somebody coughs, and like how does it transmit directly from a cough from one human to the next?
So coronavirus, like many other viruses, they survive in droplets. Like when you cough, those droplets stay in the air for a certain period of time. We know for coronavirus, it's a few hours. So that's a major concern. And once it stays in there and another person comes by, it enters into your nasal passages. And that's when it can go to your lungs and infect your lungs, and therefore one person passes on to the other. So there is that concern about someone sneezing and then it's in the air.
Okay, so then it can live there for a long time, and you might not have to get it right away into your lungs. Like the chances of if you breathe it in right away, obviously it's probably going to get to you. But let's say it lands, I don't, you know, how the virus, it lands on your clothes, and then you come home into your house. Could you transmit it that way?
So it's known, so the study that just came out showing that fabric, the stay time is a lot less. So in terms of what surface is, so stainless steel, it's up to 72 hours. On cardboard, it's up to 24 hours, which is much longer than the SARS. SARS can stay on on cardboard for 8 hours, so it's three times longer. And on fabric, it's a lot less. It's in the hours of 4 to 6 hours, so it can stay on your clothes. So the best thing is probably just to wash your clothes right away, especially if you've been on in the area where people are coughing that may have the common cold symptoms. So it's definitely a good idea to do that because it can stay on fabric, and this virus can stay much longer than most people suspected.
Let's say you're out working today, right? Or maybe you go grocery shopping. If you came to your house, took all your clothes off outside your home, and or maybe went to your back porch or something and left them outside for 4 to 6 hours, would that be wise? Or, you know, could you do that and then wash it rather than even try to bring it into your house to get it into your laundry basket?
That's probably not necessary because the most common way to get rid of the virus is soap and water.
Okay.
And that's really, that's what all the healthcare professionals are suggesting that. And that's true. Soap and water, hand sanitizer can only kill about 60% of the coronavirus. So you still need alcohol-based wipes or soap and water. That's definitely the best way to do it. So there's no need to hang it outside. Just put it in a washer, let it wash. The detergent should be able to kill the virus and remove them for you.
Okay. And so I asked that opening question because, you know, there's schools closed now and, we're told to, you know, stay social distancing from a lot of people. But any parent with kids, you know, sometimes you're like, I want some fresh air. Like, what is going for a walk dangerous?
I think you just have to be careful where you're going. I mean, in the neighborhood, it's most likely fine. It's probably fine. If you're going to a park, you do have to be cautious because now we have this data to show that 72 hours, it remains on stainless steel. And I don't know about wood, but no one's really looked at that. But in stainless steel, it can remain for a long period of time. So I think you do have to be careful for parks. It's best to stay in your neighborhood, in your backyard. And that's part of the distancing. Like, try to stay in your home area. It's the safest right now until we can get a handle on how to control and treat this virus.
So you mentioned it can live on stainless steel for 72 hours. Let's say, because right now no kids would have their bare hands on it. They would put their gloves on it. Does it transfer from stainless steel to your gloves?
It's a good question. We know fabric, it does have some resident time. So they didn't really look at that in that study. My guess is that maybe some can do that.
Okay.
But most likely not. But it's good to be careful. It's just throw it in the wash, I'll clean it up.
Okay. So here we are. We're done social distancing. You know, people are, I think Albertans overall have done a pretty good job on how everything is going right now. It's obviously in the very early stages. But as somebody who studied this virus, you know, I guess let's kind of go back to what causes it originally.
Well, the virus actually has its origin in bats, which is kind of really interesting. This was a long time ago. So coronavirus has been around since the 1960s. The first variant strain appeared in the 1960s, and then appeared again in 2003, 2004. In 2012, we had the SARS virus, but that is a form of coronavirus.
Okay.
And so now we have almost the fourth generation of the coronavirus, and they call it COVID-2, SARS-CoV-2. And that's the second strain from that original SARS that happened in 2012. And so it's been evolving, and the origin, again, is in bats for some reason. And this particular strain started in China. And because of global travel, it then started spreading. So that's where it originated from, and that's where most of the cases, about 80,000 individuals have been infected with coronavirus in China. And that's been spread all over the world. So that's all we know so far. Exactly how it evolved from bats to humans, we're not really sure yet. But there's definitely some overlap in terms of genetic sequence.
Dr. Shiraz Baksh joins us. He is the president and CEO of Bioimmunodesigns, also a former associate professor at the University of Alberta. And was a consultant working with an Edmonton company for mobile testing of coronavirus. And so that, I guess, is that kind of the next phase? I know Alberta Health and Canada Health, that they've sent out like home tests where, you know, you can at least get a good sense of maybe where you're at. But the reality is some people might not show any symptoms for 5 days, right? So you can feel good and you almost have to self-test every day because it could suddenly just pop up, correct?
Yeah, that's true. So one of the major drawbacks that we've had so far with recognizing this problem is that we're encouraging people to, initially, people are coming to health centers, right, and getting tested there, and the CDC implemented their testing. But the fact of the matter is there's so many people infected right now that we have to do a point-of-care testing, which is going to the infected population and doing testing. So that's the idea of the Edmonton-based company is trying to do mobile testing to go to areas that cannot go to the hospitals. And the virus can remain up to 14 days. Between 6 and 14 days is what the incubation time is for the virus to get into your system to multiply, to destroy cells, and then to cause the symptoms of COVID-19. So it does take some time to multiply in the system. And the mobile testing and repeated testing is definitely important. And because there have been some cases of people being infected, have symptoms, they test negative, and they don't have symptoms anymore. And then a few weeks later, they get the symptoms again. So you could get it again. So it's important to do constant testing. And I think that's where the world should be headed to because of the fact that there's so many individuals infected by this virus.
Now that was my next question, Shiraz. So if you have the coronavirus once, because sometimes with the flu, a certain strain, you get it once, you don't get that one again, but then there's all sorts of other strains. This one, you could actually, let's say I have it now, I'm isolated for 2 weeks, I recover, I'm good. A month later, I could catch it again.
It is very possible. There are some cases that have been documented already. Now, how widespread that is, we don't know yet because we're still learning about that. But the important, I think, where we're headed is constant testing for this, especially those that had very strong and severe symptoms in the beginning. This should be constantly monitored, and I think that's where we're headed because we don't have a vaccine. There are some vaccines being developed. There are some small molecule drugs that are being developed, but it'll take time for that to get to the clinic. So we need to monitor, and I think that's the concept of the company I was hired to be a consultant for, that we need to have constant monitoring and have a mobile lab to go to the areas that are vulnerable and that are susceptible to getting this infection.
Dr. Shiraz Baksh joins us here on TSN 1260 talking about COVID-19. Doctor, it's interesting about, I guess the question that a lot of people have is, on average, how long would it take? Because I know we saw, last week here in Saskatchewan, and then a group in on, they've isolated the virus. Maybe they think that by July potentially they could test it on humans, right? So if they start testing on July, is there a ballpark figure of how long you go from starting to test that it becomes actually available on the market?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And normally vaccines, they take several years before they actually make it into a human being. I know there's been a lot of push by the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, and Health Canada to fast track potential therapies because they know how serious this pandemic is. So right now, we're probably looking at 6 to 12 months. There are some companies that are more advanced than others, but that's just sort of the time frame we're looking at. It's important to recognize that we need a vaccine, but important to recognize that we need to also make sure this vaccine is safe for human consumption.
Yes.
And that's what takes some time to document and to make sure it's safe for humans. So that's the challenges we have right now. So we're looking probably at 6 to 12 months, but I know there's been a lot of work by scientists to develop this vaccine and try to get it to clinic as fast as possible.
What about, I saw a news story, they're talking about you really want to flush, your sinuses, right? Something as simple as a neti pot. Well, would that help? What about cleaning out your nose?
That would definitely help because that's where the virus enters, and your mucous membrane is very sticky. So the viruses can attach to certain areas of the mucous membrane. So if you clean that out and blowing into, that's why one of the recommendations is don't blow into your hands, blow into tissues, or blow into your elbow, because you don't want to touch another surface or touch your nose or touch your face or touch another person. So blow into tissues and then dispose of that. And that's one way of clearing the viruses from your nose. It doesn't eradicate everything, but at least it gets rid of what could potentially be there if it's there at all. And then that's one way to make sure that, you can get rid of some viral particles that might be attached to your nasal passages, because that's the point of entry.
Dr. Shiraz Box joins us. What about right now in Alberta? It's been minus 20 overnight. Is this thing, does minus 20 slow it down at all?
Well, the what they know about it, it's a virus that can explode in population in more temperate areas. Such as China, the Middle East had a version of this a few years ago. And so temperate climates are definitely better. Not better, but the virus can propagate better in those conditions.
Yes.
With minus 20, it definitely is slower, but there hasn't been a proper study to show that.
Okay.
But definitely there is different predictions for temperate areas versus subtemperate areas versus colder climates.
Doctor, right now there's a lot of people concerned, and we look at all like the worst case scenarios about this. When you've seen kind of how we've reacted right now to it and moving forward, like the vast majority of the population who does get COVID-19 is going to be able to come through it unscathed, right? Can we kind of outline who are the most vulnerable and how can we help them?
Yeah, so about 89%, but closer to 90% of those that do get infected with the virus they present with mild conditions. But those that are older population, over 70 years old, immunocompromised, those that have asthma or any kind of lung issues such as cystic fibrosis, those are populations that are susceptible to the virus because the virus enters through the lungs, populates in the lungs, and destroys the lungs, the cells of the lungs. And so you have breathing disorders, short of breath. And those are the susceptible population. So the news reports are all saying older individuals are the most susceptible, and we should be very concerned about them, and we should be. But also kids that have asthma, we also should be very concerned about them. Kids that have cystic fibrosis, also very concerned about them. So those are the vulnerable populations for sure.
So I've read online people say, well, because usually it enters through the nose for the most part, right? So why then are people saying those masks don't stop it?
It's a good question. So they don't. One of the reasons why it doesn't, because the mask only have one particular layer, and that layer will basically protect you against certain sizes of microorganisms. With the viruses tend to be much smaller than bacteria, and so the problem is that you need more layers in these masks. And I know I do know the company I'm involved with is creating these triple layer masks.
Okay.
To prevent that. And you need basically masks to stop those smaller particles, which viral particles can be. So that's one of the reasons why it's preventative, but not absolute, because of the fact that viral particles are much smaller.
Well, yeah. So it would help you, but it's not like if you wear one that you're going to be, hey, I can walk around and do whatever I want, is what you're saying.
No, you still have to be taking necessary precautions. And again, washing your hands as soon as you get home or closest bathroom, wash your hands, especially if you've been around individuals that are sneezing and coughing. So that's soap and water works well, and it tested to work very well.
Somebody with, you know, such a vast background in medicine, and, you know, you've researched so many different things. When you look at this, Shiraz, what's your best guess on, you know, how long this, because a lot of it's unknown. Is it too hard to determine what happens now over the next 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks in Alberta?
Well, we've been very proactive in social distancing, proactive in education of the public, and staying at home and limiting social gatherings. So that's definitely good. I think we will still see some increase in cases because this information is slowly getting to the public. And the hope is that in the next month or so, 2 months or so is my guess, things will start slowing down as we know more, as testing becomes more and more widespread. And I think it's important to do the widespread testing because we don't know who's infected or not, and we need to definitely establish that. What most people think over the next several months, the number of cases will go down as summer approaches. Well, what scientists predict and epidemiologists predict is that in the fall, we'll start seeing this again. And high numbers are predicted for next season. So it's something that we have to prepare ourselves for. And that's a very important thing that we haven't talked about, what could happen over the next year or next winter. And so that's something we definitely need to start considering and start taking precautions now.
Yeah, and that was my next question, because I'd listened to a podcast with a doctor saying how they think it might slow down, almost go dormant in the summertime, and then pick back up in influenza season in October. So let's say by middle of April, you know, we've done a really good job of social distancing it, and everybody, we're getting proper tests and we're doing okay. What can we do then, even though if it looks quiet and everything's good, not to get too comfortable? What has to continue so we don't get hit hard in October?
That's a good question. I think we're slowly learning what are the measures we need to take. Now, definitely positive and negative testing is important. The active development of a vaccine is something that I think a lot of scientists are working on, and I think we need to get something. The one thing with the SARS epidemic that we had, we never came up with a good vaccine. Now, I think part of it was that, the fact that it started in 2002 and ended in 2004, and we haven't seen a case since then, so everyone stopped working on the SARS vaccine for the most part. So that's something we really need to push scientists to try to still work on this, because it's going to happen again, and it's happened before in the past. So it will happen again, so it's something we need to proactively determine how to better monitor this, and not only monitor in the healthcare in hospitals, but also at airports and different locations, because it's something that is influenced by global travel. So it's something that we need to be aware of, and we need to actively, you know, monitor it and also work on a vaccine and a treatment for it.
Dr. Shiraz, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Thank you for having me on the show. Great show.